This audio lecture is brought to you by RTS on iTunes U at the virtual campus of Reformed Theological Seminary. To listen to other lectures and to access additional resources, please visit us at itunes.rts.edu. For additional information on how to take distance education courses for credit towards a fully accredited Master of Arts in Religion degree, please visit our website at virtual.rts.edu.
And then May says, and I haven't processed all of this yet because it's pretty fresh with me, but May says that the soul has a conversation with God before it becomes a conscious conversation in our heads. And I don't know about this, but it kind of struck true when I thought about it, because sometimes, you know, you'll be praying and it's already decided and something was going on some other place that you didn't have your vote in. And I think there's some truth to that, that the soul has its conversation with God in the quiet, you know, interpret the prayers in words, groans, it talks about in Romans, what the Holy Spirit does, that something may be going on with that reality, which is the real us, that we're not aware of in our conscious mind, and it's sometimes presented to us as a fait accompli. And so this couple, and he gave a number of illustrations throughout the book, where somebody would be on drugs. And they'd still want to do drugs so bad, but all of a sudden they knew they didn't have to anymore. Well, let me tell you something. A lot of this prison stuff has to do with things like that. I can give you all the teaching in the world. And you can know, I'm going to give you a 7-step process to get out of a prison, you know, as opposed to a 12-step program. But that stuff, and it's all helpful, it's all true, and it all works. But there's something else going on here that's behind that, and that's the supernatural reality of God who would set you free, of God who is more concerned with your freedom than you are, of a God who wants you to risk, a God who wants you to understand His grace and His love. And sometimes, I think it sort of happened with me. I think when I resigned from the church, and I think I've told you, I taught grace before that, I just didn't apply it to myself. But during that year, in a supernatural way, I began to apply it to myself. And I knew it before. I don't know why I didn't do that before. But something in me said, okay, it's time. Now you'll understand. And so that goes on. And there's a supernatural thing that we're fighting. There are demonic forces. Let me just say a word. I don't need to say this to you, but I always say it when there are a lot of lay people in a conference. We are not dualists. You know, I believe that we give Satan the power that he has. I think he's God's lackey. You know, the Job passage, there's all kinds of stuff where the demon, what is it? The serpent has been slain, but his tail still swishes. And we've all experienced that. And I think it's really dangerous when you begin to start focusing on the supernatural battle to the exclusion of the reality and the rest that we have in God. Satan is God's lackey. The battle's been won. We're not dualists. We don't do the yin-yang thing. We don't think that, you know, have you ever heard a preacher use the illustration that the devil casts a vote against you and God casts a vote for you and you cast the deciding vote? That's from the pit of hell. That's just not true. That's dualism in its rankest form. So the next time your pastor says that, go say, I know what you mean. And I know the way you're shoving us to a volitional choice for righteousness. But don't say it that way, because that's not a cool way to say it. Because we're not dualists. And so the battle's been won. And generally, what we have to do is recognize that there is a battle, claim it, and then deal with that in the reality of our own means of grace that we have with communion and prayer and fellowship and the Bible and church and et cetera, et cetera. My brother one time, you know, you all have never lived at a time when you didn't have garage openers. But believe it or not, there was a time when we didn't have television and we didn't have garage openers. And my brother, when he got his first garage opener, just would sit out and just click it and watch his thing go up. And he'd click it and watch it go down. Say, man, what are you doing? He'd say, it's an effective prayer life. Well, there's a thing sort of like that we click it. And all the powers of the universe, because we're His beloved, all the powers of the universe are called to our side to stand against the powers of Satan. I don't generally in the seminars talk a lot about this because I don't want that to be, again, I think Satan receives power insofar as we give it to him. But I do bring it up because there is this thing that Gerald May talks about that goes on that is supernatural, where God moves in and says, you're free and I'll let you go. And you can almost sense that physically sometimes when coming up with some of these things. Lie number five, and I think this is the final lie. I'm the only one who knows the prison, and I'm the only one who feels the pain. 1 Peter 4:12, beloved, do not think it strange concerning the fiery trial, which is to try you, as though something strange were happening to you. I started hyperventilating one time. You know what hyperventilation is? That's when you think you're going to die. And I've been under a lot of pressure. We had to make the decision about whether to light the candles in this old Presbyterian church or not. They were saying when the candles are on, the power is gone, and it made us papish, and we were Roman Catholics, and we didn't do stuff like that. And so I just called the session after a church service, and I said, look. And a dear saint had given these gigantic candle holders that were on this altar. I didn't want to tell them, we got an altar in our church, man. That's where we're Roman Catholic. But they had these gigantic gold, and they were literally this high. And they didn't want to take them down because she's giving a lot of money to the church. And I said, look, we're going to light those suckers, or we're going to throw them away and melt them down and get what we can get out of them. So you're going to have to decide. So we decided we're going to light the candles. And it's a major decision. But that, and then I had, that was minor. But there was a bunch of stuff that was happening that week. And I woke up one morning, and the room is going around. And I'm thinking, you know, I'm only 27, and I'm dying. Or 30, and I'm dying of a heart attack right here. So I went to see my doctor, and he came and said, what do you want? I said, man, I'm done. I got a heart attack. You made me come down here. You should have come to see me. The room was going around. I was in big, big time pain. He said, what's been happening? And I told him. He reached into his desk and he got out a bag and he handed it to me and he said, breathe in it. And I said, what? He said, curl it up like this and breathe in it. You're getting too much oxygen. It's called hyperventilation. That's the only thing that's wrong with you. You had your physical 3 months ago. You're not having a heart attack. And I felt so relieved. I'm so glad. And people who, what do they call it? What do they call when you're afraid of everything? What is it? No, it's anxiety, but it's agoraphobics, right. Agoraphobia is when you just don't, you won't even go outside of your house. That's how that starts. You hyperventilate, then somebody tells you, oh, you poor dear, we got to do something about this. And they start giving you all kinds of medication, and the next thing you know is that you're just scared of everything. And I'm so glad when I went into him that he gave me that paper bag. And he said, Brown, breathe in the bag. Take it with you. You can have it free. Be cheaper than anything I give you. And I never had the problem again, ever in my life. What if he had really gotten serious and said, oh, man, that's bad? That's what we do in the church. You, as a religious professional, must learn not to be shocked or surprised by anything. You've got to learn, because you know yourself, that you shouldn't be shocked. I have written in one of my Bibles, you wouldn't be shocked at your own sin if you didn't have such a high opinion of yourself. And I think I'm going to write under that, you wouldn't be so shocked at your own neurosis if you didn't have such a high opinion of yourself. And you wouldn't be so shocked at your egomania if you didn't have such a high opinion of yourself. And I think what happens in the church is that we learn to hide and protect ourselves. And so we never show people who we really are. Do you ever wake up at 2 o'clock in the morning really scared? Well, me too. And you're in seminary. You ever think, maybe after you've been studying for exams, you know, what if this stuff's not true? Man, I'm spending a lot of money to come here, and I'm going to give my life. What if it's not true? You ever know it was sin? People always say, well, Christians don't commit first-degree sin. I always commit first-degree sin. I mean, I ain't never sinned. I didn't think about it a while first, then decided I'm going to do it. Sin hardly ever sneaks up on me and just gets me. I always kind of say, you know, call it. And so, first, you ever do that? First-degree sin? I mean, you knew it was wrong. You knew God was telling you. You had a scripture verse to go with it, and you did it anyway. Me too. You ever made a fool of yourself and thought, I don't know if I can be around those people anymore. I've made a fool of myself in front of thousands and had to ride the elevator with most of them right afterwards. You ever think if they knew me, they wouldn't let me in this seminary? You ever? Me too. You ever think, man, everybody's got it together? I look around and these people love God, and I watch them pray, and that's not true with me. Me too. And everybody in this room said me too to yourself when I was talking. And see, we don't do that much in the church because we don't want to. I know Christian radio ministries and television ministries that will not allow any reality for fear of hurting the name of Christ. You don't hurt the name of Christ. He's doing fine. I mean, he doesn't need us to help him become pure and perfect. He is. And so there's this thing that goes around that I'm. I think I told you all about flying, and getting on the. At 32,000 feet outside of Philadelphia with that. Have I told you that? Well, maybe. Some of you have been in some of my classes. I don't remember what story. You've probably heard all these stories 12 billion times. But I was in Philadelphia and was late for a... woke up early. I was at the Philadelphia Airport Hotel and thought I can get an earlier flight and get back a lot sooner. And so I jumped out of bed and threw everything I had in the suitcase. And I was going out the door and I looked back and I had the little travel alarm clock that I travel with, and I just stuck it in my attaché case, ran down the concourse or whatever it is and got on the plane and got on it. And at 32,000 feet, this awesome alarm went off. And it was really loud. And the guy next to me was reading the Wall Street, I fly like this, and I fly a lot. And he's reading the Wall Street Journal, nonchalant. He threw it in the air. And the woman behind me screamed. and then I was ready. If there was any place to go, I'd have gone. You know that statement about when they went to Muhammad Ali, the flight attendant, and said, put your seatbelt on, sir. And he said, Superman don't need no seatbelt. And she said, Superman don't need no plane. Well... So this is what, and I don't know where it's coming from, man. I want to go somewhere, but there's no place to go. And I'm thinking, we're going to die. And then I realized it's coming from my attaché case. And I was not a popular person. I opened up the attaché case. First, I thought, I'm just going to let it run down. And I thought, man, it ain't even running down anytime soon. And so I got it out, and I clicked it up, and I held it up and said, I'm sorry. And I was not a popular person. Put it back in. But you know what it said to me? It said to me, you know, all those cool people on airplanes, never bothers, they're lying. They're just as nervous as I am. And they think before they get on the plane, this could go down and I could die too, just like I do. And ever since that happened, I feel a little bit better about flying. I look around and I think the flight attendants are just as scared as I am. And their odds are worse than mine because they do this all the time. They could die and they know that. It's true in the church too. And sometime you ought to set off an alarm clock just to see. Sometimes you need in the church... to really do something radical so people will get honest with one another, and they don't much. And so it's like giving religious professionals in the church what we do. I've got a lady that I've been writing to for a long time. I've met her one time, but she's a really delightful lady who is so delightful, and she loves God, and she's always recommending books to me and evangelists, and we've been writing for about 2 years now. And she, and I've got to be really careful with this, she recently didn't fall but got tempted in a really bad way. And she said, I want you to pray for me because this is really hard. And she said, but I'm not going to tell you what it is because you'll be really upset. And finally, after about four letters, she'd talk about other things. And then she'd say, and she's just one, I mean, she really loves God. And she said, Duke, don't forget to pray for me about this temptation. Well, I know what the temptation is, but I'm not saying that. I said, well, you can tell me, friends, you can tell me if you want to. If you don't, that's okay. So finally it got so bad, she in the last letter just poured it out, this relationship that was established, and she didn't know what to do about it, and she needed to run, and it was hard to run, because, and on and on and on, she just poured it out. And you know what I wrote her back? I didn't quote theology. She knows that. I didn't give her Bible verses. I sent her a one-sentence letter, and it was, welcome to the club. And what did I do? I gave her a paper bag and told her to breathe in it. And what we as leaders in the church need to do is be giving out a lot of paper bags. It's so important we do that. And if we don't, we get into some really serious trouble in terms of the neurotic things that happen in a church. Okay, those are the five lies.
You have reached the end of this lesson. Please continue listening to this side for the next lesson.
All right, we are now talking about the reasons why people stay in their prison. I suggested, just to bring you up to speed, that the prisons, as C.S. Lewis said through Aslan, are prisons of our minds. It seems to me that the gospel is quite clear that we don't have to stay in those prisons, and yet that's exactly what we do. I was answering a letter today from somebody and said I simply couldn't understand why people who read the Bible don't understand what I understand about it. That could be arrogance, and I have on occasion fallen into that particular sin. However, it seems to me that almost always when you read the Gospels, Jesus is mad at folks like us and not people that are bad. And we do just the opposite. From our position of moral superiority, we pick out who are the gross sinners in our midst and we go after them. And just a cursory reading of the Gospels would suggest that just the opposite was true of Jesus of Nazareth. But I find that true as I read through the New Testament. If you take, and I'm big on systematic theology, I am not like some people who read systematic theology for their fun time. I mean, it's not something that one reads for fun as far as I'm concerned. But I love systematic theology because it puts it together in a way that you can understand the witness that the Bible makes. And it seems to me that anybody who systematically tries to understand the New Testament understands that something radical has happened, something of major import. And it wasn't that we simply revert to an old-style legal obedience to the law. It doesn't throw out the law, but it says something very important and something radical about it. And that has to do with our being able to get out of the prisons that we find ourselves in. We've been talking about some of the reasons, and let me give those to you very quickly up to this point. We talked about the proctors of the prison, the people that are into power, Galatians 3:1, that often people who are insecure, sometimes even godly, and sometimes in an effort to protect the people of God, will continue to maintain the prisons that are made in the name of God. Then we talked about some lies that, then we talked about the pedagogy of the prison. All of these begin with a P because they made me do that. Then we looked at some of the lies under that particular category. The lie, I'm not in prison and there is no pain. The Christian Scientist, I'm not in hell and it is not hot. And then we saw the lie that I must accept the prison and the pain. So many Christians are there. They just simply think that it's always been this way. It always will be that way. And they're simply going to have to live with that. I personally believe that a lot of misunderstood Reformed theology suggests that to the people in the pews. That God is God, He is sovereign, so deal with it. And whatever He has dealt you, the cards that He's given you, you've got to play and you've just got to deal with those. And if that happens to be a dysfunctional family background, if it happens to be the punishment that you think you deserve, then that is sovereign. That is a sovereign God who made that decision for you. And then lie number three, I deserve the prison and I deserve the pain. Lie number four, I can't change the prison and the pain. We saw that that was like one, but it had supernatural implications about it. That sometimes we forget that there's a supernatural side of the Christian faith that's completely aside from rationalism. And that there is an involvement that we have with Satan and with the powers of evil that are recognized in an inadequate way by Jung and a lot of others, but is very real. Lie number five, I'm the only one in the prison, and I am the only one who feels the pain. And that's where we ended last week, and so I'm going to start with number three. A lot of these were subcategories within major points, and this is the third major point of the reason why people stay in prison. We've noted the proctors and the pedagogy of the prison, and I want to talk to you a little bit about the pathology of the prison. Exodus 14, 11 through 12, God's people at the Red Sea and on the verge of freedom. And then they start complaining to Moses about what he has done to bring them out of their comfortable prison. Because there were no graves in Egypt, have you taken us away to die in the wilderness? Why have you so dealt with us to bring us up out of Egypt? This is not the word that we told you in Egypt, saying, let us alone that we may serve the Egyptians. For it would have been better for us to serve the Egyptians than we should die in the wilderness. Now, I'm going to talk about three specific things that have to do with the pathology of the people that are in the prison. And the first has to do with security. And the second has to do with control. And the third has to do, by way of repetition, because we've talked about it before, is the feeling that we need to be punished. First, we have a desire for security. It's been said so often that it's become a cliche that if people are given the choice between totalitarianism and anarchy, they will choose totalitarianism any time. In fact, I would, given that particular choice. Would you like to have a dictator, or would you like to have anarchy where everybody does his or her own thing? And there's this awesome fear of not being secure, and we will choose totalitarianism every time. My wife has suggested, though it has not come true yet, that she feels that our country is moving in the direction of a dictatorship. And she says that is because people want security. And the more that crime becomes rampant in our streets, the more open we are to somebody who talks good, who says, I'll fix it, to turning over constitutional powers to that particular person. False security is more important to most people than promised freedom. I have a friend, and he's still my friend, and if I were to mention his name, you would recognize it because it's a well-known name. He's been involved for a number of years in what some people have called a cult. It's probably not a cult. It's a place where I have a lot of friends, but it has a high degree of authority and obedience that is given to this particular group. They have what they call light groups, and people sit around and they examine people's sin over and over again so that people can walk better in obedience with Christ. There are discipline measures that are imposed on everybody within this particular community to obey Christ. Every time I go there, I love the people who are there, but I feel a cloying inside that I just want to get out. I want to scream. I want to spit on the well-manicured lawns or take a candy wrapper and throw it on the pretty place. There's just something about it that gets to me. And that was always my... Yeah, sort of like Celebration. Palm Springs is like that way, too. Celebration is that way in Palm Springs. I mean, there is no more beautiful place on the face of the earth. I've been invited there a number of times to speak for conventions and things, and I don't go there anymore because I can't stay in the place, man. It just makes me want to scream. All the streets are all nice, and everything is set up, and everything is perfect, and you know, the grass is green because they water it all the time. It's out in the middle of the desert, and I just want to go spit or tear up paper and just throw it all over the place just to see. There's something that's unreal about that sort of thing. It's kind of a Stepford Wives thing that gets to you. And I'd always felt this way about this particular group, but I never verbalized those opinions to them or anybody else because I believe there are different strokes for different folks, and maybe some people grow in that sort of situation. But my pastor friend, the man that you would know, called me one night, and it was 2 o'clock in the morning. And he was crying, and he said, Steve, you've got to get me out of here. He said, I don't know what to do, and I don't know where to go, and I don't know how to be involved. And I've been out of the real world for so long, I don't remember what the real world is like. And he said, would you open some evangelical doors for me? And I said, yeah, I'd be glad to. Man, I'm so proud of you, because I know that's a big step, and you've been there a very long time. And he thanked me over and over again, and we prayed together, and he hung up. And the interesting thing is that within 3 weeks, he was back there, and he had recommitted his life, not to Christ, but to that particular community where there was heavy authority. What was going on? The truth was that he liked the security of being there, and the thought of being free from that was very, very scary. If you ever read the cult books, you find that happens all the time. It's not the difficulty of leaving, it's the difficulty of staying out because of the security that's provided within that particular context. Looking and thinking and acting like others, not being called rebellious, libertarian, or antinomian, controlled by other people is comforting, obeying rules provides a certain kind of security. You need to know that I get criticized a whole lot, and I don't like it. You need to know that probably the ministry where I'm the spokesman receives more critical letters per capita than any other ministry in America. We get 7,000 letters a month, thousands of emails, and thousands of phone calls. And of the 7,000 letters, 6,999 are people who are upset with something that I've said. And I know how to stop it. I really do. I know how to stop it. I know if I would just say nice things and be a little nicer and didn't say what I think and quit trying to push the envelope, I know I'd start getting positive letters. I suspect that the income would go up in this particular ministry. I suspect that people wouldn't be so critical of me. And I want you to know, I want to do that so bad, I can't tell you. In our afternoon show, the way that we've geared that particular show is to bring in some really edgy young Christian guys. Because I know that I'm an old guy and that I don't think the way they think. And they see things different than I see. But they see things that are well outside the commonly accepted Orthodox Christianity that most of us are a part of. And so there are times when they say things on the show when I go, oh, man, am I going to get killed for that? And that happens over and over and over again. But the interesting thing is that the ratings keep going up because normal people start listening and they start saying, you know, he's making a point there. But I can't tell you the number of times when I've gone back to my study at Key Life and I've said, I'm not going to do this anymore. I simply cannot deal with this kind of criticism that I'm receiving. Now, I'm not a particularly strong person, I want you to know. If I didn't owe all the money that I owe and have to pay all the people that I have to pay, I would become a monk if they would let me take my wife in a monastery outside of Conyers, Georgia. I love that place. It's a Trappist monastery, and I love visiting there. And I'd go there if they let me bring Anna. And I'd just get away from all of this because there is in me a desire for security. But Christ has reminded me over and over again, and His Spirit has told me over and over again, that that's a place of deadness and a place of great pain. And you can trade your security or your freedom in on security and miss the joyous experience of following Christ if you're not careful. I got a letter this morning. Jennifer Prechter comes into my office once a week, and she answers. She's a student here, and some of you know her. Jennifer comes into my office, and she works under Robin, my daughter, and her particular job description is to answer theological letters and particular letters that have to do with what's going on in the church. And she will ask me questions, take notes, or sometimes I'll type something on our Outlook thing and send her an email to it. But the idea is so that she can say, as you can imagine, Steve can't answer all the letters that we receive, but I personally talked to him, and this is what he said, and then she puts quote in it. This morning when we were going through some of the letters, she was asking me, or was bringing me a letter, from a man who was in a church who was asking, what about a pastor, and should a pastor be under any authority? And the question was, do we have popes, and what's the difference between a Protestant church that has a pastor who's a pope and the Roman Catholic Church who has a pope? And evidently this person who asked me the question had been through a very difficult time, and I have real problems with a pastor who isn't submissive to somebody. If you don't have a place of accountability, you have no business serving in leadership in the body of Christ. And I want to say that because I believe that with all of my heart. But I wanted to be very, very careful, because if I give that person an inch, they'll take a mile. And pretty soon, they will assume that it is the responsibility of everybody to control everybody and of the board of the church to control the pastor so that he has to ask whenever he goes to the bathroom. There's something that causes us within the church to revert to authority. I don't know if you're charismatic, but if you are, one of the greatest divisions within the charismatic community happened just over the cell group movement and the heavy authority structure that was exerted.
This audio lecture is brought to you by RTS on iTunes U at the virtual campus of Reformed Theological Seminary. To listen to other lectures and to access additional resources, please visit us at itunes.rts.edu. For additional information on how to take distance education courses for credit towards a fully accredited Master of Arts in Religion degree, please visit our website at virtual.rts.edu.